I'm going to be starting on time today because the sutta being read out this afternoon is number 12, the Mahasihanada Sutta. I've been going through the discourses which have already been explained and are online. So I've been choosing the ones which haven't been read out yet. And there's always a good reason why they haven't been read out. Either they're not all that interesting or they're extremely long. So this is one of those extremely long ones. So I would ask you not to have too many questions, otherwise we'll be here till 6 o'clock. But those of you who haven't got your books, on the table over there, there are the photocopies of the sutta. We have the slowest photocopier I've ever seen in this Buddhist Society of West Australia. That took me a couple of hours to do those. So it would be wonderful if you can get your own books. So we wouldn't have to waste paper and waste a lot of time. But hopefully everyone's got a copy. Very good. So we'll start now. Those who come in late have to come in late. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So today we're going to be reading out the Mahasihanada Sutta. It gives you an understanding of the extent of these teachings you find in the middle-length sayings. There's some interesting stuff in this, some not so interesting stuff, but here it all goes. And again, for those of you who haven't got the copies of the book yet, on the table you'll find some photocopies of the sutta to be read out today. So there's photocopies of the sutta on the table. Thus have I heard, on one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Vaisali in a grove outside the city to the west. Now on that occasion, Sunakata, which means basically good astrology sign, son of the Lichavis, had recently left this dharma and discipline. In other words, he used to be a monk. Now he's disrobed. He was making the statement before the Vaisali assembly. The recluse Gotama does not have any superhuman states, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. In other words, he was saying the Buddha, you know, he was just a monk, but he never actually was enlightened. He never had anything which was interesting. And it was mentioning here in the notes that there was another sutta, the Sunakata Sutta, in number 155, that was expounded to him by the Buddha before he joined the order. And the leaving the Sangha is in the Pataka Sutta, number 24, where he became dissatisfied and left the order because the Buddha would not perform any miracles for him, or to explain the beginning of things for him. So he was a monk who basically wanted to come into the Sangha for some really weird ideas, maybe wanted to see psychic powers, and the Buddha never showed him any. And in the Pataka Sutta, actually, the Buddha showed him a few. But that wasn't enough to get him to come back into the Sangha. And when it says the distinctions of knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, those are called the Uttarimanusa Dhamma. Those are those states which monks aren't supposed to show or to tell people. Now, lay people, we can tell each other, these are your states of enlightenment, your stream winner, once returner, non-returner, or arahat, things like your jhanas. And interestingly, Hachabhamadi was saying that even in one place, the Buddha was saying even the nimittas, he called them uttariminusadhamma. But that's a bit suspicious because it doesn't fit in with the rest of the things which the Buddha said. Where Uttarimanusa Dhammas were just the jhanas and the stages of enlightenment. Oh, they would also include psychic powers as well. So the recluse Gotama, does not have any superhuman states, and it distinguishes in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. The recluse Gotama teaches a Dhamma merely hammered out by reasoning, following his own line of inquiry as it occurs to him, and when he teaches the Dhamma to anyone, it leads him, when he practices it, to the complete destruction of suffering. I'll just go here. The criticism is the Buddha teaches a doctrine that's merely worked out in thought, rather than one he's realized through transcendental wisdom, and he believes that being led to the complete destruction of suffering is, as a goal, inferior to the acquisition of miraculous powers. So he just wants to go in there, not to be released from suffering, but to get powers. So sometimes people do that. I can never forget the first year I was here, when someone came to see, a young kid came to see Ajahn Jacaro and sat in front of him and said, "Okay, how much?" And Ajahn Jacaro said, "What do you mean, how much?" He said, "How many inches, how many feet?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, how high can you levitate? Come on, how many inches, how many feet?" And that's all he was interested in. So, Sunakata had just left the Sangha. Then when it was morning, the Venerable Sariputta, dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Vaisali for alms. Then he heard Sunakata, son of the Lichavis, making this statement before the Vaisali assembly. When he had wandered for alms in Vaisali and had returned from his alms round, after his meal, he went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and told the Blessed One what Sunakata was saying. And the Blessed One, the Buddha, replied, "Sariputta, this misguided man, Sunakata, is angry, and his words are spoken out of anger. Thinking to discredit the Tathagata, he actually praises him. For it is praise of the Tathagata to say of him, when he teaches the Dhamma to anyone, it leads him, when he practices it, to the complete destruction of suffering." So he thought he was criticizing the Buddha, but actually he was praising him. Just as I said in my latest book, that if someone calls you a loser, then that actually, in the Dhamma discipline of the Buddha, that is a great praise, a great accolade. You're losing your defilements, you're losing your attachments. To be a loser is a great praise. So if anyone calls you a loser, just like Sunakata, they may think they're criticizing you, but actually they're praising you. And Sariputta, this misguided man, Sunakata, will never infer of me, according to the Dhamma, that Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teachers of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. That's the words of Tipiso Bhagawa, Alahang Sammasam Buddho. Vijja Chavana Sampanno Sukhato Lokavidu, that's knower of the worlds. That doesn't mean that he can see aliens in outer space. Knower of the worlds means of the worlds of where we can get reborn. The Kama Loka, that's the world of animals and of ghosts and of even hell realms, and the Rupa Loka, the realms of, actually the Kama Loka goes up to the heaven realms as well, and the Rupa Loka, the Jhana realms, and the Arupa Loka, the immaterial realms. Those are the three worlds, the Tiloka, the three worlds which the Buddha knows all about. Incomparable leader of persons to be tamed. I love that saying because it means that not everybody can be trained, but you know, those who can be trained, the Buddha can do it. And teach of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. And he will never infer of me, according to Dhamma, that Blessed One enjoys the various kinds of supernormal power. Having been one, he can become many. Having been many, he can become one. He appears and vanishes. He goes unhindered through a wall, through an enclosure, through a mountain, as though through space. He dives in and out of the earth as though it were water. He walks on water without sinking as though it was the earth. Sitting cross-legged, he travels in space like a bird. With his hands he touches and strokes the moon and sun, so powerful and mighty he wields bodily mastery even as far as the Brahma world. All those psychic powers are probably well known, except for the weird ones of touching and stroking the moon and the sun. That was always this really strange one. But the other ones of, you know, going into the earth and through mountains and stuff, that's it's not maybe seen, but it's known as something which is supposed to be done by great meditators. And he will never infer of me, according to Dhamma, with the divine ear element, which is purified and surpasses the human. The Blessed One hears both kinds of sounds, the heavenly and the human, those that are far as well as near. And he will never infer from your cognitive Dhamma, that blessed one encompasses with his own mind the minds of other beings, of other persons. In other words, reading people's minds. That he understands a mind affected by lust is affected by lust, unaffected is unaffected by lust, a mind affected by hate is affected by hate, unaffected is unaffected by hate, understands a mind affected by delusion is affected by delusion, a mind unaffected is unaffected. He understands a contracted mind is contracted, a distracted mind is distracted. Contracted mind is one which is supposed to be sloth and torpor. Distracted is one which is restless. He understands an exalted mind is exalted, an unexalted mind is unexalted, a surpassed mind is surpassed, unsurpassed is unsurpassed, a concentrated mind, I call that a still mind because it's samadhi, a still mind is still, an unstill mind is unstill, a liberated mind is liberated, an unliberated mind is unliberated. And those ones all, apparently, according to the commentary, refer to one and the same thing, a mind in jhana or a mind outside of jhana. And for those of you who know the Satipatthana, that is exactly how they call the third Satipatthana, as the awareness of the mind. But that's another thing. In this context over here, it means that you can read minds. So if we were translating that into English rather than word for word, we say that Sunakata would never think that he's a Buddha, would never think that he has the ordinary psychic powers, would never think that he could read minds, would never infer that he could like hear these far-off sounds. So that's what he can't do. And now the Buddha actually starts to give his lion's roar. This is a Sihanada. A lion's roar is a Buddha actually saying what he can do, rather than beginning with what he can't do. Sariputta, the Tathagata has his 10 Tathagata's powers, possessing which he claims it literally is the bull's place, roars his lion's roar in the assembly, and sets rolling the wheel of Brahma here. Interesting, the wheel of Brahma instead of the wheel of the Dhamma. Now, in the commentary, which I'll put at the back there for you. Actually, I think this might be a... Is that a mistake there? Because it says over here, the Buddha sounding the wheel... on the Buddha sounding of the lion's roar, under the wheel of Brahma, the wheel of Brahma is the supreme, best, most excellent wheel. The wheel of Dhamma is in its twofold meaning, the knowledge penetrating the truth and knowledge how to expound the truth. So the Dhamma Chakra is a knowledge of the truth, but this also includes the knowledge how to teach the truth as well. So the Brahma Chakra is bigger than the Dhamma Chakra. So it's only a strange way of saying it, but he said it. So what are those 10 powers of a Tathagata, of a Buddha? Here the Tathagata understands as it actually is, the possible as possible, and the impossible as impossible. And that is one of the Tathagata's powers that Tathagata has, by virtue of which he claims the leader's place, roars his lying war in the assemblies, and sets rolling the wheel of the Brahma. And apparently that means the knowledge of the correlations between causes and the results. In other words, he knows what the cause is and exactly what it can cause, what it can't cause. That's what's possible and what's impossible. And again, the Tathagata understands as it actually is, the results of actions undertaken, past, future and present, with possibilities and with causes. This too is the Tathagata's power. Again, the Tathagata, in other words, understands the law of karma. They always say that the law of karma is very difficult to understand and only a Buddha penetrates it fully. And again, the Tathagata understands as it actually is, the ways leading to all the destinations. That too is a Tathagata's power. Again, the law of karma. And again, the Tathagata understands as it actually is, the world with its many different elements. That too is a Tathagata's power. And again, the Tathagata understands actually as it actually is, how beings have different inclinations. That too is a Tathagata's power. And that was actually used to teach people. It's one of the great powers of a teacher. When they can see a person and know exactly how to pitch the teachings, exactly whether they're deep teachings or small teachings, in a way that they can understand. So they know the inclinations. Sometimes if you teach a high Dhamma to someone who hasn't got great wisdom, They cannot understand it. They can even get upset at you. If you teach low teachings to people who really want to find out something more deep, it upsets them. So the Buddha understands the inclinations much better than anybody else. So you can pitch the teachings at the right level. And again, the Tathagata actually is the disposition of the faculties of other beings, of other persons. That too is the Tathagata's power. You know, faculties are always changing. Sometimes you're in a very good state of mind with few hindrances. Sometimes you've got not so many hindrances. So this is being able to teach a person that who's open to the Dharma at certain times in their life. Sometimes they're close to the Dharma. When they're really open, can actually see that, understand it, and teach accordingly. And again, the Tathagata understands as it actually is the defilement, the cleansing, and the emergence in regard to the jhanas, liberations, concentrations, and attainments. That too is the Tathagata's power. With the jhanas, that's the jhanas, liberations is vimokas, concentration is samadhi, and attainments are samapatti. Some of these words are not meant to relate to different things, but to the same things used as in different aspects. The jhanas are known as the liberations, and the concentrations, I'll say, that's just the states of samadhi. So they are pretty much those first few that are the same. The attainments, especially the attainments, are on the path to enlightenment. And again, that is again a very difficult one to understand sometimes. I've often pointed out that it's pretty easy to understand the first level of stream winning, the third of non-returning, and the last of arahat, but the second one is a very, very difficult one to pin down, which is the once-returner. And again, here we go to the psychic powers. The Tathagata recollects his many past lives, one birth, two births, thus with their aspects and particulars, he recollects many past lives. That is the Tathagata's power. And again, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, the Tathagata sees beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, according to their karma. And he understands how beings pass on according to their karma. That too is the Tathagata's power. And lastly, the most important one, again, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge that the Tathagata here and now enters upon and abides in that deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints, the asavas, I call them outflowings. That too is the Tathagata's power that the Tathagata has, by virtue of which he claims the herd leader's place, roars his lions roar in assemblies, and sets rolling the wheel of Brahma. The Tathagata has these 10 powers, possessing which he claims the herd leader's place, roars his lions roar in the assemblies, and sets rolling the wheel of Brahma. Sariputta, when I know and see thus, should anyone say of me, the recluse Gotama does not have any superhuman states, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. The recluse Gotama teaches a Dhamma merely hammered out by reason, following his own line of inquiry as it occurs to him. Unless he abandons that assertion and that state of mind and relinquishes that view, then, as surely as if he had been carried off and put there, he will wind up in the hell realms. Just as a bhikkhu possessed of virtue, concentration and wisdom, siddha samadhi panya, would here and now enjoy final knowledge, so will happen in this case. I say that unless he abandons that assertion and that state of mind and relinquishes that view, then as sure as if he had been carried off and put there, he will wind up in a hell realm. So that's what happens by criticizing the Buddha. But his chances are, eventually he will give up that wrong view. If you want a question, you have to get so we'll just wait for the question times, but it's a good time to stop for any questions. If you want to ask a question, you've got to get the microphone.
I was just wondering on the last point, if the person does have to be in the Buddhist dispensation, or can someone outside the dispensation doesn't believe it, he'll also go to hell then?
That is a bit difficult. I think that this is specifically for him. So it is not really said there. I would imagine that this is specifically for him because he goes around telling other people. And it is in the sense that by criticizing and blaming, dispelling people's faith in the path of that, in itself is stopping people entering a path which leads to enlightenment, which leads to freedom, stopping them from entering that path, which is one of the great causes of bad karma. Bad karma is not just hurting other people, but is preventing them from doing good. And because that's the highest of the goods, preventing them from doing such good is very bad karma. And I mention that to people over in Singapore and Malaysia, where very often one of their children wants to become a monk or a nun, and the parents stop them. And they're stopping them from doing something which is very wonderful and very good. And by hindering a person doing good karma, that is very bad karma for them. So this is him hindering somebody having faith in the Buddha and maybe joining the Sangha. Yes.
Arjun, if you go back to the first page, section 5, it says, Sunakata will never infer of me according to the Dharma, the Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened. And that's usually the phrase for someone who's seen the Dharma. So is he saying here that Sunakata can't become a stream winner?
Okay. Where is it? I think that would be never contingent on as long as he keeps on discrediting the Buddha and saying such words. In other words, never as long as he's misguided, because there's nothing such a thing as a never forever. It always changes, as you know.
I just thought maybe he was in a situation where he'd committed an offence where he couldn't see the Dharma, for instance, if he'd killed his parents or...
Well, obviously that what he was saying there, criticising the Buddha, does not count as one of those impediments, those obstacles which cannot be overcome for a lifetime. But even those, you may not be able to become enlightened in this lifetime, but the next one you can. So it's not really never in the sense of never ever for the whole eternity. Okay, now the Buddha, this is a very human discourse in the sense that sometimes when you criticize somebody, especially if you criticize a teacher, I shouldn't really say this, but that really gets them going and they give a much deeper and more powerful discourse as a result of that. It's as if they say, I'm going to show you. And because of Sunakata, you know, criticizing the Buddha, he said, right, here we go, I'm going to really show you what I'm made of. And I've seen that happen quite a few times. I do remember an old story of our forest tradition where one of Ajahn Mun's monks, they hadn't heard a talk for a long time from Ajahn Mun. So on arms round, one of the monks opened his bowl and took out a banana which should not be eaten until you go back to the monastery and walked right past Ajahn Mun eating a banana. Just to upset the teacher, he did this on purpose. He did it just to upset him so that evening the teacher would give a sermon. Now, please don't do that at Bodhinyana monastery. But you can see that when there's something to be said, you know, it really arouses the Dhamma in somebody and they give a really rip-roaring Dhamma discourse. So this is what really happened here. So the Buddha continues with his four kinds of intrepidity. In other words, places where many people will be afraid, but the Buddha never is. So, Puta, the Tathagata has these four kinds of fearlessness, possessing which he claims a herd leader's place, roars his lion's roar in the assemblies, and sets rolling the wheel of the Brahma. What are the four? Here I see no ground on which any reckless or Brahmin or God or Mara or Brahma or anyone else in the world could, in accordance with the Dharma, accuse me thus. While you claim full enlightenment, you are not full enlightenment in regard to certain things. And seeing no ground for that, I abide in safety, fearless, and intrepidity. In other words, that no, he can claim enlightenment without any fear, without any trepidation. And the reason is because he is enlightened. Because a lot of times, if anyone claims to be enlightened, or any stage of enlightenment, you know, that people will test you out. And they'll try and find out, is he really enlightened or is he not enlightened? I'm going to check this guy out or this girl out. And that's one of the reasons why you were advised, even though it does say in the Vinaya, you're not supposed to tell anybody, it makes a lot of sense to not tell anybody, because it was one of Chi Kwang's teacher, Chi Kwang Soon Lim, the Korean Zen nun who lives over in Melbourne, but she's a Perth girl. She once told me that her teacher said, If you ever do get enlightened, don't tell anyone, otherwise you'll have to spend the rest of your life proving it. Which is actually a very wise saying. Because if you say you're enlightened, people are going to test you out for the rest of your life. So the Buddha says, you can test me out as much as you like, because I am. That's the first, fearlessness. Number two, I see no ground on which any recluse, Brahmin, God, Mara or Brahma, anyone else in the world, could accuse me thus. While you claim to have destroyed the outflowings, those outflowings are undestroyed by you. And seeing no ground for that, I abide in safety, fearlessness and intrepidity. So full enlightenment, outflowings, the same. I see no ground on which any recluse, Brahmin, God or Mara or Brahma, anyone else in the world, could accuse me thus. Those things called obstructions by you are not able to obstruct one who engages in them. And seeing no ground for that, I abide in safety, fearlessness and intrepidity. And of course, those obstructions to Nirvana, he's saying, I know these are obstructions. If you say they're not, I will say they are. He's fearless in that. And one of those obstructions, which is part of the Vinaya, there was one monk who said that sensual desire is not an obstruction. He said that no more that you can stop your sexual desires as you could put your fist in the Ganges and stop the current. And the Buddha said, no, that's not wrong. That is wrong. The sensory desire is an obstruction. It can be overcome. This is the way it's overcome. And so this monk said it wasn't an obstruction. The Buddha said, yes, it certainly is. So even in those days, so people would say, no, you're just being a bit too extreme, trying to stop these natural desires of the human form. The Buddha says, yes, you can do them. So that what he called obstructions, he said were obstructions. And lastly, number four, I see no ground on which any recluse or anyone at all could accuse me thus. When you teach the Dhamma to someone, it does not lead them, when they practice it, to the complete destruction of suffering. And seeing no ground for that, I abide in safety, fearlessness, and intrepidity. Now that's a very powerful teaching, they say. When you teach the Dhamma to someone, you cannot say it doesn't lead them, when they practice it, to the complete destruction of suffering. So that gives every one of you a lot of faith, because these are the Buddha's teachings. If you practice it, the Buddha knows it will lead you, if you practice it, to the complete destruction of suffering. That's his fearlessness. So don't think it can't be done. So the Buddha has these four kinds of fearlessness, possessing which he claims a hired leader's place, walls his lion's walls, and sets rolling the wheel of the Brahma. So Sariputta, when I know and see this, if anyone say of me the opposite, they will wind up in hell. So these are the four fearlessnesses, basically fearlessness on his own attainment, he's absolutely certain that's it, and also on his ability to teach and knowing what are obstructions. Now the eight assemblies, now this is sometimes a bit of a weird stuff, but here he goes. Sariputta, there are these eight assemblies. What are the eight? An assembly of nobles, Brahmins, householders, of recluses, of gods, of the heaven of the four great kings, assembly of gods of the heaven of the 33, assembly of Mara's retinue, and assembly of Brahmas. It doesn't go through all of the usual heaven realms, only just four of them. Possessing these four kinds of intrepidity of before, the Tathagata approaches and enters these assemblies. I recall having approached many hundred assemblies of nobles, many hundreds of assemblies of Brahmins, many hundreds of assemblies of householders, hundreds of assemblies of recluses, hundreds of assemblies of gods of the heaven of the four great kings, hundreds of assemblies of gods of the heaven of 33, hundreds of assemblies of Mara's retinue, many hundreds of assemblies of the Brahmas, and formerly I had sat with them there and talked with them and held conversation with them, yet I see no ground for thinking that fear or timidity might come upon me there. And seeing no ground for that, I abide in safety, fearless, and intrepidity. Now, of course, that is a bit strange. But number one, to having an assembly, that was that was actually the where in the world, in the time of the Buddha, the local communities would have assemblies where they would discuss matters of governance, have a vote, and decide accordingly. It was a reference to the democratic institutions around the Sakyan Republic, around Vaisali, and many other parts of India where there were assemblies to decide things. It seems really a bit strange that they would have assemblies in the Brahma realms, but here we have it. It doesn't really make so much sense here, but I think what it really means in essence is that when you go to an assembly, when you are confident in your attainments and abilities, you don't get so afraid. I know that when I was well trained by Ajahn Chah, especially in the monks' rules of discipline, you could go to many other monasteries without fear. You knew exactly what you were doing. You knew what the rules were, what the rules weren't, so you could go there confident that you were a good monk, and if there was any criticism, it would just go over you. I remember going to Ajahn Mahabua's monastery as a monk from Ajahn Chah's monastery. This was actually a different sect of Buddhism in Thai, the two different sects. And when I went there, I was fearless because I was keeping a good Vinaya. I also learned Thai. And the first day there, when I was helping with the chores, you know, pulling water from the well, the other Thai monks didn't understand that I could speak Thai fluently. And so I listened to them criticizing me. And they were saying, oh, that monk, that Western monk, he came yesterday by himself. He didn't have an attendant with him. That means he must take money, because you can't live in Thailand just going by yourself without an attendant, unless you have sort of your own money. So he obviously has money. Obviously, it was totally false. You don't need to have an attendant to go with you when you walk through the streets of Thailand. Many monks, including the old forest monks, including Ajahn Chah, would go from place to place by themselves without money. But so that's what they were criticizing me. But I was fearless. Not only did I understand what they were saying without them realizing it, but also I kept good Vinaya. So if as long as you know what you're doing, you keep a good sense of Vinaya, Avena Upasamo, wherever you go in the world, you are confident, you're not afraid. Any monastery of your tradition or other traditions, you know what you're doing, you're at peace, you're confident, you're without fear. So now another weird little paragraph. The four kinds of generation. Sariputta, there are these four kinds of ways of generating life. What are the four? Egg-born generation, womb-born generation, moisture-born generation, and spontaneous generation. What is egg-born generation? They are these beings born by breaking out of the shell of an egg. This is called egg-born generation. What is womb-born generation? There are these beings born by breaking out from the core. That's an old English word that means, you know, this thing in the womb. This is called womb-born generation. What is the moisture-born generation? There are these beings born in rotten fish, in rotten corpse, in rotten dough, in a cesspit, in a sewer. This is called moisture-born generation. What is spontaneous generation? There are gods and the denizens of hell and certain human beings and some beings in the lower worlds. That is called spontaneous generation. These are the four kinds of generation. These are just beings who just appear. So I know that's supposed to be true of the heaven realms. If you go into a heaven realm, you're not born as a baby, Deva, where you have to be weaned and go to school and grow up and go through adolescence. As soon as you appear in heaven realm, you're fully formed. And there's also not supposed to be any decay in heaven. There's no like old age homes for geriatric Devas. You know, when you get old, you just fade away, die very quickly. So that's, you know, you appear spontaneously, fully formed and mature, and you basically leave fully formed and mature without old age and decay. But what is interesting, when I first read this, certain human beings appearing spontaneously. In other words, not going through school, not going to university, not being babies, they suddenly just appear. And I know that as a kid, I used to sort of read these weird tales about people who just appear fully formed. And they never went through school, no mother, no father. That's really weird. I don't know if you've had any tales about those beings who spontaneously appear in this world. You've got one, Chris. Okay, this is interesting.
I had some experience some Aboriginal folk who were involved in the desert people and the elders in the desert, and these people would send people to look after kin that are in various parts of Australia. And this person was telling me these stories. These people would just appear fully formed out of nowhere and know exactly what these people were, know everything about them, know their names, and then they would turn around, blink, and they'd just not be there anymore. So that's a story about Aboriginal elders who perhaps may have those sorts of abilities.
Wow. Is there anybody here?
Top that.
Who has spontaneously come into existence? Yeah, you got one.
I can't top that.
I can't top that.
But I'm sure I've read in accounts of Thai monastics who have psychic powers, seeing, for instance, the consciousness of one being entering into another one and like evicting it. Is that possible?
That's a different story, but yeah, I've heard that as well. There was a famous story going around Thailand when I was a young monk of this going to weird stuff, nothing to do with the sutta, of a man who died in a village, and obviously the medicine was not really that top in the village. We don't know if he really died or not, but anyway, he was supposed to be dead, and they were going to do the funeral the next day, but that evening he woke up. And he had a totally different personality. And he said he came from another village close by. Because after he had died, a few hours later, another guy died in another village. And so his stream of consciousness left his body and came into this body. It was like, you know, the first guy's stream of consciousness exited. The second guy saw there was an opportunity to actually get a quick rebirth. And he got reborn. So he was reborn in a new body. And interestingly, what I found interesting, in his new body, you know, he had his wife, he had his family, they recognized him in his body, but they didn't recognize his personality. And eventually he went to the other village and stayed with his old family, who couldn't recognize his body, but recognized his personality. His personality was more important.
Yeah, this is getting off the track a bit, sorry.
Yeah, we're really getting off the track.
Okay. You know, for instance, if you look at situations that have studied reincarnation and their timelines don't necessarily match up. For instance, the person who got reincarnated didn't necessarily have that 9 months period in between.
Yeah.
So there seems to be cases where the consciousness can actually go into a body that's already formed.
Yes, yeah.
So there's not necessarily that a 9 month gap there.
Indeed. Sometimes even a 1 week or 2 week gap, I've seen those cases as well. It's very rare that it gets reborn or it goes into a new body after the birth. That's quite rare. But anyway, that's interesting. So it really doesn't tell anything about spontaneous human beings, but spontaneous devas, yes. And also the Buddha was saying about the five destinations in Nibbana. Sariputta, there are these five destinations, places where you can get reborn. The hell, the animal realms, the realm of ghosts, human beings, and the gods. And he says, I understand the hell and the path and way leading to the hell realms, and I also understand how one who has entered this path will, on the dissolution of the body after death, reappear in a state of deprivation in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. So you not just understand there is this, but how you get there. I understand the animal realm and the path and way leading to the animal realm, and I also understand how one who has entered that path will, on the dissolution of the body after death, reappear in the animal realm. In other words, why they go there. I understand the realm of ghosts and the path and way leading to the realm of ghosts. And I also understand how one who has entered this path will, on the dissolution of their body after death, reappear in that realm of ghosts. I understand human beings and the path and way leading to the human world. And I also understand how one who has entered the path will, on the dissolution of their body after death, reappear among human beings. I understand the gods and the path and way leading to the world of gods, and I also understand how one who has entered this path will, on the dissolution of the body after death, reappear in a happy destination in the heavenly world. And I also understand Nibbana and the path and way leading to Nibbana. And I also understand how one who has entered this path will, by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge here and now, enter upon the abiding that deliverance of mind and deliverance of wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints, the asavas. So like the five destinations, plus Nibbana. So again, the Buddha is just telling just the extent of his wisdom. And the next paragraph. Now this is an interesting one here because this I've often used this one to show one of the words which confuses people in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Ekayana, where sometimes that some people say that this is the only path, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. Now the word there is Ekayana, and the only other place where that particular word appears in the suttas is right here in this next paragraph, and I'll point it out to you. We often quote this little section here to give people a much better understanding of what that word must mean in the Satipatthana Sutta. You know, what sometimes calls the only path, the one and only path, the direct path. Now that is not really a translation which many people accept these days. And this is the reason why, coming from this paragraph. Paragraph 37. By encompassing mind with mind, I understand a certain person thus. This person so behaves, so conducts themselves, have taken such a path that on the dissolution of the body after death, they will reappear in a state of deprivation in an unhappy destination in perdition in hell. And then later on, with the divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human, I see that on the dissolution of the body after death, they have reappeared in a state of deprivation in an unhappy destination in perdition in hell, and they experience extremely painful, racking, piercing feelings. Suppose there were a charcoal pit deeper than a man's height, full of glowing coals without flame or smoke. And then a man, scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched and thirsty, came by a path going in one way only. That's Ekayana. And directed to that same charcoal pit. Then the man with good sight on seeing him would say, this person so behaves, so conducts themselves, has taken such a path that they will come to this same charcoal pit. And then later on they see that they have fallen into that charcoal pit and are experiencing extreme, painful, racking, piercing feelings. So too, by encompassing mind with mind, I know this. So this is why the Buddha understands why certain person reappear here while they reappear in another destination. Because it's the path which is going in one direction only, they say, with no forks, you know, no U-turns allowed. So you know that path is only one place you can end up. So that is actually one of the great meanings in the Satipatthana Sutta. It's a path which goes in that direction, there's no U-turns, there's no forks. If you keep doing it, this is where it's going to lead. This is where it's going to lead. And paragraph 2 is again a permutation on the previous one. By encompassing mind with mind, I understand a certain person thus. This person so behaves, so conducts themselves, has taken such a path that on the dissolution of the body after death, they will reappear in an animal realm. And then later on, with the divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human, I see that on the dissolution of the body after death, they have reappeared in the animal realm and are experiencing extremely painful, racking, piercing feelings. Suppose there were a cesspit deeper than a man's height, full of filth, and then a man, scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched and thirsty, came by a path going in one way only, Ekayana again, and directed to the same cesspit. Then a man with good sight on seeing him would say, this person so behaves that he will come to this same cesspit. And then later on he sees that he has fallen into that cesspit, and is experiencing extremely painful, racking, piercing feelings. So too, by encompassing mind with mind, I see that this is going to happen. By encompassing mind with mind, paragraph 39, by encompassing mind with mind, I understand a certain person thus. This person so behaves, so conducts himself, has taken such a path that on the dissolution of the body after death, they will reappear in the realm of ghosts. And then later on I see that he has reappeared in the realm of ghosts and is experiencing much painful feeling. Suppose there were a tree growing on uneven ground with scanty foliage casting a dappled shadow, and then a man scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched and thirsty, came by a path going one way only and directed to that same tree. Then the man with good sight on seeing him would say, this person so behaves that he must come to that same tree. And later on he sees that he has sitting or lying in the shade of that tree, experiencing much painful feeling. So too, by encompassing mind with mind, I realize this. For paragraph 40, by encompassing mind with mind, I understand a certain person thus. This person so behaves, so conducts themselves, has taken such a path that on the dissolution of the body after death they will reappear among the human beings. And then later on I see that he has reappeared among human beings and is experiencing much pleasant feeling. Suppose there were a tree growing on even ground with thick foliage casting a deep shade, and then a man scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched and thirsty, came by a path going in one way only, and directed to that same tree. Then a man with good sight on seeing him will say, this person so behaves that he will come to the same tree. And then later on he sees that he is sitting or lying in the shade of that tree, experiencing much pleasant feeling. So too, by encompassing mind with mind, I know these things. By encompassing mind with mind, I understand a certain person, thus this person so behaves, so conducts themselves, has taken such a path that on the dissolution of the body after death, they will reappear in a happy destination in the heaven world. And then later on, I see that they have experienced, later on I see that he has reappeared in a happy destination in the heaven world and is experiencing extremely pleasant feelings. Suppose there were a mansion and it had an upper chamber plastered within and without, shut off, secured by bars with shuttered windows, and in it there was a couch spread with rugs, blankets and sheets, with a deerskin coverlet, with a canopy as well as crimson pillows for both head and feet. That was the what they call desres, desirable residence in the time of the Buddha. Those were the furnishings which the modern Indian in the time of the Buddha would aspire towards. You would obviously think of a better mansion than that, but nevertheless, that's what they have here. You get the meaning. And then a man, scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched and thirsty, came by a path going in one direction only, and directed to that same mansion. And a man with good sight on seeing him would say, this person so behaves that he will come to the same mansion. And then later on he sees that he is sitting or lying in the upper chamber in that mansion, experiencing extremely pleasant feelings. So too, by encompassing mind with mind, I know these things. By encompassing mind with mind, I understand a certain person thus. This person so behaves, so conducts themselves, has taken such a path, that by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge, they here and now will enter upon and abide in that deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. And then later on I see that by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, they here and now, actually should be, instead of here and now, should be in this very life, as Sanditiko, enters upon and abides in deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints that are experiencing extremely pleasant feelings. Suppose there were a pond with clean, agreeable, cool water, transparent with smooth banks, delightful, and nearby a dense wood, and then a man, scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched and thirsty, came by a path going in one way only towards that same pond. And a man with good sight on seeing him would say, this person so behaves that he will come to this same pond. And then later on he sees that he has plunged into the pond, bathed, drunk, and relieved all his distress, fatigue, and fever, and has come out again, is sitting or lying in the wood, experiencing extremely pleasant feelings. So too, by encompassing mind with mind, I understand these things, these five destinations. The only interesting thing there is actually the similes. Remember, for the hell realms, that's a charcoal pit burning, which really hurts. The ghost realm is like being in a cesspit. And not the ghost realm, that's the animal realm, they say. Maybe they don't know the animals in Australia these days who live very comfortable lives, but maybe in those days it was like being in a cesspit. The ghost is sometimes in a dappled tree, so a little bit of happiness, a little bit of sadness there, which is interesting. A simile for the human being, you're under a nice shady tree, so it's quite pleasant. For the gods, you're in a mansion where you can really lay down comfortably. And Nibbana is you've drunk from the well, so you're parched, your thirstiness has disappeared, and you're now resting in the forest. So, Kuta, when I know and see thus, should anyone say of me, the reckless Gotama does not have any superhuman states, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones? The reckless Gotama teaches a Dhamma merely hammered up by reasoning, following his own line of inquiry as it occurs to him. Unless he abandons that assertion, that state of mind, and relinquishes that view, then as surely as if he had been carried off and put there, he will wind up in hell, just as a bhikkhu possessed of virtue, concentration and wisdom would here and now enjoy final knowledge. So what happened in this case, I say that unless he abandons that assertion and that state of mind and relinquishes that view, then as surely as if he'd been carried off and put there, he will wind up in the hell realm. So this is just certainty of people who are criticizing him when the Buddha is saying exactly what he's been doing. And now the Buddha goes into his austerities. And they say here simply because they were saying that this guy, Sunakata, really was impressed by monks and nuns who lived very simple lives and lived austere lives. Now, when I read this, we all know that the Buddha said he did this, but it's not recommended today. But even so, a lot of people, they really respect a monk or some practitioner who is really, really ascetic. Even if it makes them sick and kills them, they respect it. So please don't do that. Otherwise, you'll encourage our monks and nuns to make themselves sick when you think, ah, you eat too much. Ah, you know, you sleep on cushions. You should sleep just on ground. Ah, you sleep inside. You should sleep outside on the trees. Ah, you should do as this one English monk a long time ago. He heard that a good monk only wears three robes because he read this story that the Buddha in India, even though it was very cold, he would only wear three robes and that was it. So he was staying in London. He went out on Hampstead Heath in the middle of the winter just with his three robes and stayed out all night meditating in the winter, in the snow. In the morning they had to take him to hospital where he had pneumonia. He was there for many, many days. So he goes too far with some of the austerities which even monks today do. Yeah, it may be impressive to some of you, but it is pretty stupid. Sorry? Yeah, no, but some people are. The more austere they are. I remember one Chinese lady, she said she would never have any faith in a fat monk. So that lets me out of it. Anyway, here he goes, the Bodhisattva's austerities. Now, the Bodhisattva is describing the Buddha before he was a Buddha. Sariputta, I recall having lived a holy life possessing four factors. I have practiced asceticism, being as ascetic, a supreme ascetic, that's the extreme of asceticism. I have practiced coarseness, the extreme of coarseness. I practice scrupulousness, the extreme of scrupulousness. I practice seclusion, the extreme of seclusion. Such was my asceticism, Sariputta, that I went naked, rejected conventions, licking my hands, in other washing instead of washing them, not coming when asked, not stopping when asked. This is when going for alms food. So they ask you, if they ask you, please stop and take some alms, he would not stop. He did not accept food brought or food specially made or an invitation to a meal. So you know, we accept invitations to go to people's houses for a meal. The Buddha never did this. He would only receive food on alms round. I'd receive nothing from a pot, from a bowl, across a threshold, across a stick, across a pestle, from two eating together, from a pregnant woman, from a woman giving suck, from a woman lying with a man, from where food was advertised to be distributed, from where a dog was waiting. He let the dog get it first of all. Even from where flies were buzzing, let the flies get it first of all. He didn't want to take food from the flies. I accepted no fish or meat. I drank no liquor, wine, or fermented brew. I kept to one house to one morsel. So I'd go on alms round only one house a day and one morsel from that house. I kept to two houses, two morsels, seven houses, seven morsels. I lived on one saucerful a day, on two saucerfuls a day, seven saucerfuls a day. I took food once a day, once every 2 days, once every 7 days, and so on up to once every fortnight. I dwelt pursuing the practice of taking food at stated intervals. I was an eater of grains or millet or wild rice or hide parings or moss or rice bran or rice scum or sesame flour or grass or cow dung. That's a bit rough, eating cow dung. I lived on forest roots and fruits. I fed on fallen fruits. I clothed myself in hemp. In hemp mixed cloth, in shrouds, that's from the charnel grounds which used to cover dead bodies, in refuse rags, in tree bark, in antelope hide, in strips of antelope hide, in crystal grass fabric, which was very sharp and cut you, in bark fabric, in wood shavings fabric, in head hair wool, in animal wool, in owl's wings. I always thought that was a bit weird, owl's wings. I'm sure it must be owl's feathers. I was one who pulled out hair and beard instead of shaving it, pursuing the practice of pulling out hair and beard. I was one who stood continuously, rejecting seats, would never sit down. I was one who squatted continuously, devoted to maintaining the squatting position. I was one who used a mattress of spikes. I made a mattress of spikes in my bed. Somebody actually gave me a mattress of spikes about a year ago. I won't say who it was. I said, why don't we be more ascetic in Bodhinyana Monastery? And they spent hours and hours making this bed with lots of nails in it. I don't know what happened to that. Is that still there somewhere? Okay. We should have taken that to auction last night. They're really heavy, though. Anyway, mattress of spikes. I made a mattress of spikes in my bed. I dwell pursuing the practice of bathing in water 3 times daily, including the evening. It's amazing. That's like an ascetic practice. Now, maybe if it's in a cold weather and it's not a shower, but just cold water, maybe that is what is meant. So these days, like bathing 3 times a day, that's just what you do, especially in Thailand. It's so hot there that people are always bathing. But this must be cold weather in cold water. Thus, in such a variety of ways, I dwell pursuing the practice of tormenting and mortifying the body. Such was my asceticism. Such was my coarseness, Sariputta, that just as a bowl of a tinduka tree accumulating over the years cakes and flakes off, so too dust and dirt accumulating over the years caked off my body and flaked off. In other words, never had a bath. And it never occurred to me, oh, let me rub this dust and dirt off with my hand, or let another rub this dust and dirt off with their hand. It never occurred to me that such was my coarseness. Such was my scrupulous, Sariputta, but I was always mindful in stepping forward and stepping backwards. I was full of pity, even for the beings in a drop of water. Thus, let me not hurt the tiny creatures in the crevices on the ground. Such was my scrupulousness. Such was my seclusion, Sariputta. I would plunge into some forest and dwell there. When I saw a cowherd or a shepherd or someone gathering grass or sticks or a woodsman, I would flee from grove to grove, from thicket to thicket, from hollow to hollow, from hillock to hillock. Why was that? So they should not ever see me, or I see them, just as a forest-bred deer, on seeing a human being, flees from grove to grove, from thicket to thicket, from hollow to hollow, from hillock to hillock. So too, when I saw a cowherd or a shepherd, such was my seclusion. I would go on all fours to the cow pens when the cattle had gone out and the cowherd had left them, and I would feed on the dung of the young suckling calves. As long as my own excrement and urine lasted, I fed on my own excrement and urine. Such was my great distortion in feeding. That was a bit of distortion. I would plunge into some awe-inspiring grove and dwell there, a grove so awe-inspiring that normally it would make a man's hair stand up if he were not free from lust. When those cold wintry nights came during the 8 days intervals of frost, I would dwell by night in the open and by day in the grove. In the last month of the hot season, I would dwell by day in the open and by night in the grove. And there came to me spontaneously the stanza never heard before, chilled by night and scorched by day, alone in awe-inspiring groves, naked, no fire to sit beside, the sage yet pursued his quest. I would make my bed in a charnel ground with the bones of the dead for a pillow, and cowherd boys would come up and spat on me, urinated on me, threw dirt at me and poked sticks into my ears, yet I do not recall that I ever aroused an evil mind of hate against them. Such was my abiding in equanimity. Sariputta, there are certain requisites and Brahmins whose doctrine of view is this. Purification comes about through food. They say, let us live on kola fruits. That must have been a very sort of simple fruit in the time of the Buddha. And they eat kola fruits. They eat kola fruit powder. They drink kola fruit water. And they make many kinds of kola fruit concoctions. Now, I recall having eaten a single kola fruit a day, Sariputta. You may think that a kola fruit was bigger at that time, yet you should not regard it so. The kola fruit was then at most the same size as now. Though feeding on a single kola fruit a day, my body reached a state of extreme emaciation. Because of eating so little, my limbs became like the jointed segments of vine stems or bamboo stems. Because of eating so little, my backside became like a camel's hoof. Because of eating so little, the projections on my spine stood forth like corded beads. Because of eating so little, my rubs jutted out as gaunt as the crazy rafters of an old roofless barn. Because of eating so little, the gleam of my eyes sank far down into the sockets, looking like a gleam of water that has sunk far down in a deep well. Because of eating so little, my scalp shriveled and withered as a green bit of gourd shrivels. And I missed out here. And if I defecated or urinate, I would fall over face down. Because of eating so little, my belly skin adhered to my backbone. This, if I touched my belly skin, I encountered my backbone. If I touched my backbone, I encountered my belly skin. Because of eating so little, if I tried to ease my body by rubbing my limbs with my hands, the hair rotted at its roots and fell from my body as I rubbed. Sariputta, there are certain recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this: purification comes about through food. Let us live on beans. They say, let us live on sesame. They said, let us live on rice. They eat rice. They eat rice powder. They drink rice water. They make many kinds of rice concoctions. Now I recall having eaten a single rice grain a day, Sariputta. You may think that rice grain was bigger at that time, yet you should not regard it so. The rice grain was then at most the same size as now. Through feeding on a single rice grain a day, my body reached the same state of extreme emaciation. Yet, Sariputta, by such conduct and such practice, by such performance or austerities, I did not attain any superhuman states, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. Why was that? Because I did not attain that noble wisdom which, when attained, is noble and emancipating and leads the one who practices it in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering. So I've gone in great length to describing these things, which sometimes people like to hear because it's fascinating, that he said it didn't lead you anywhere. Sariputta, there are, 57, there are certain recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine of view is this: purification comes about through wandering through the rounds of rebirth, and eventually, so if you keep on going, eventually you will get there. But it is impossible to find a realm in a round that I have not already passed through in this long journey, except for the gods of the pure abodes. And had I passed through the round as the god of the pure abodes, I would never have returned to this world. And you all know the reason why, because who goes to the pure abodes, the Sudawasas? It is the Anagamis, yes. So they go there and never come back again. So that's the only realm the Buddha said he'd never been to. If he went to that one, he'd never come back here again. That's where Anagamis, a person becomes an Anagami in this life, gets reborn in a Sudawasa, the pure abodes. There they get final enlightenment and their final nirvana. So he'd been everywhere instead of the pure abodes. So obviously it's not a question of going here and all over the place. Once you've taught the whole of samsara, then you're out. There are certain regulations and Brahmins whose doctrine of view is this: purification comes about through some particular kind of rebirth. But it's impossible to find a kind of rebirth that I had not been reborn in already in this long journey except for the gods of the pure abodes. So just getting reborn in the Western paradise is not enough to make you an arahat. There are certain recluses of Brahmins whose doctrine view is this: purification comes about through some particular abode, but it's impossible to find a kind of abode that I have not already dwelt in. There are certain, except the gods of the pure abodes, there are certain recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine view is this: purification comes about through sacrifice, but it's impossible to find a kind of sacrifice that has not already been offered up by me in this long journey when I was either a head anointed noble king or well-to-do Brahmin. There are certain recluses and Brahmins, like sacrifice means you can't buy yourself to Nibbana. You can't say, Ajahn Brahm, come on, you've got friends in high places. If I give a big donation to the nuns and monastery, can I become a stream winner, please? You can't, no sacrifices is possible. That's shame. Never mind. There are certain recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine of view is this: purification comes through fire worship, but it's impossible to find a kind of fire that has not already been worshipped by me in this long journey, when it's either head anointed noble king or well-to-do Brahmin. Sariputta, there are certain recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine of view is this: as long as this good man, or you may say all women, is still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessings of youth in the prime of life, so long is he perfect in his lucid wisdom. But when this good man is old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, and comes to the last stage, being 80, 90, or 100 years old, then the lucidity of his wisdom is lost. But it should not be regarded so. I am now old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, and come to the last stage. My years have turned 80. So this was obviously spoken in the last year of the Buddha's life. Now suppose that I had 4 disciples with 100 years lifespan, perfect in mindfulness, retentiveness, memory, and lucidity of wisdom. Just as a skilled archer trained, practiced, and tested could easily shoot a light arrow across the shadow of a palm tree, suppose that they were even to that extent perfect in mindfulness, retentiveness, memory, and lucidity of wisdom. Suppose they continuously asked me about the 4 foundations of mindfulness, and that I answered them when asked, and that they remembered each answer of mine and never asked a subsidiary question or paused except to eat or drink, consume food, taste, urinate, defecate, and rest in order to remove sleepiness and tiredness. Still, the Tathagata's exposition of the Dharma, his explanations of the factors of the Dharma, and his replies to questions would not yet come to an end. But meanwhile, those 4 disciples of mine with 100 years' lifespan would have died at the end of those 100 years. So, Puta, even if you have to carry me about on a bed, still there will be no change in the lucidity of the Tathagata's wisdom. They're just saying that even he's old, his wisdom is always very strong. No, doesn't forget things, no way of forgetting Alzheimer's. Rightly speaking, were it to be said of anyone, a being not subject to delusion has appeared in the world for the welfare and happiness of many, out of compassion for the world, for the good wealth and happiness of gods and humans, it is of me indeed that rightly speaking this should be said. So before we finish off there the Buddha has actually decided to tell the monks exactly what he's been up to, that he has got great understanding of all these amazing things, that he is fearless, he can go anywhere, he knows what he's been doing, he knows the Dharma so well, that he knows things like how beings come to be, especially in the heaven realm, spontaneously. He knows the 5 destinations, how people get there, and about Nibbana, how they get there. And if anyone says that he doesn't know what the austerities are like for the long round of rebirths, he's done every type of austerity. And even to say that now he's old, he doesn't know what he's talking about, he was just saying his lucidity of wisdom is still very, very strong. What he's doing over there, he was just saying that he has the authority to teach. Yes, you have a question? Yes, go on. Yeah, you've got time.
I was just wondering, like all these ascetic practices that the Buddha did, it was right before he became enlightened. So how could the Buddha, who was the most wisest, I guess, stream of consciousness, because he became a Buddha at that time, how could he have been so deluded? And also he's been using a lot of willpower, so I was just wondering, using all that willpower, would it have like increased his sense of self and therefore kind of preventing him? Because then he got enlightened right away after, it seems, very closely.
Yeah, no, this is an interesting question. Why did the person who was about to become a Buddha have to do, or why did he do 6 years of ascetic practice? And it's a very, very good question. Number one, it shows that just before you were a Buddha, it doesn't mean you were a very wise person before. It means that on that enlightenment experience, you really have a massive change from being a person who's probably more stupid than most by doing such a story of practices and becoming immediately more wise than anybody. So what I gained from that is to say that you don't have to be a special person, or it doesn't appear to be a special person today to be an arahat tomorrow. You can be very, very stupid, and very, very, have some very weird ideas. But when the insight comes, it totally overturns what you thought was right before, and you see something very, very different. So those enlightenment experiences are very cathartic. Not as of a gradual change from one state to another, but a huge state. It's a huge change, all in one insightful experience. But it's true, you would have thought the Buddha was wise enough not to do that. But of course we are reborn, we may have been, as I suggest, in a previous human life, a disciple of Kassapa the Buddha, reborn in this life in a good family, but we are influenced by the prevailing philosophies of our time. And the prevailing philosophy of that time was very much the Jaina philosophy of by austerity, by asceticism, you can actually find the truth. Now, the idea which persisted in medieval Christianity, you know, to torture the body, to mortify the flesh, to free the spirit. And you know, that was very common in so many cultures. You see that it is it might even be like almost like a psychosis of the mind to always think through austerity you can gain things, gain benefits. And the Buddha was obviously just following the prevailing practices of his day. The more austere, the more ascetic, he thought, the closer you'd get to enlightenment. And just wasting so many years following a dead-end path. And then coming to that point of frustration, you know, where your back's against the wall, you've tried everything you've known and nothing works. And then he decided to remind himself of these wonderful experiences of jhana. And then totally changed his direction. So the one thing you can say is that it was a mistake. So even the person who was about to be the Buddha made mistakes. It makes enlightenment much more possible for us, especially for you. You're allowed to make mistakes and you can be enlightened tomorrow. But it also actually shows us that was the first teaching of the Buddha when he said, please don't do that. Don't be so austere. And it's a very difficult thing for me as a senior monk at Bodhinyana to try and find that level of simplicity which is not austere. It's a very, very difficult line to find when you're practicing as a Buddhist. You know, there's this middle way. Now, you want to be comfortable with your body, but how comfortable? Now, how good should the food be? How comfortable should the dwellings be? You know, should you have aircon in the monk's huts? Or should you sleep on the floor, should have a bed, or whatever it is? And it's always a little balance, a hard balance to find. In some of the monasteries I've been to, there's one monastery where I stayed in Kuala Lumpur. And my goodness, the room they gave me is like a presidential palace. It's obviously way beyond what is really appropriate for a monk. There's other places which are very, very austere and people can't even get a good night's sleep. So to find that right level of simplicity, which is not austere, but which isn't indulgent, is a very, very difficult thing to find in this world. And in the end, you can't say that one standard fits all people. When you get old, you need basically more comfort to keep the body healthy and fit. When you're very young, you can just almost sleep anywhere and still be fit and healthy. So, and depending on where you're born, what you're used to, so what is comfortable and allows your body to be in good health, that changes from time to time in your life, from person to person. The Buddha went a bit too far in that. And I would also say that, you know, as a Western monk in Thailand in those early years, it went too far to austerity. You know, we didn't really look after our bodies enough in those early years in northeast Thailand. It may be okay for the Laotian, the northeasterners who were used to that type of lifestyle, but it was very tough, you know, dealing with mosquitoes and diarrhea and all this other stuff coming from bad food. You know, and the heat and everything else. I was telling people over in Thailand just last week that I'd always have trouble with sleepiness in the morning when meditating in the forest monasteries in northeast Thailand. But then I had to do my visa, renew it for the year, so I went down to Bangkok to renew it. Stayed about 3 or 4 days, and the place we stayed then was in this city monastery called Wat Pa Won. They just built a new block for visiting monks, so we were allowed to stay there for 2 or 3 days for our visa. And in that visitor's block, they had a hall which was air-conditioned. Now, we hadn't seen an air conditioner for years. And because we would get up early in the morning at 3 o'clock, we had permission to use that from 3 o'clock till just before the alarm sound, about 6. And we go and meditate in there, and that was for the first time every morning, had no sloth and talk at all. It was perfectly clear. And it didn't take an Einstein to work out. It was the climate which was contributing quite strongly to your sloth and torpor. You know, in those very humid, hot jungles in the early morning, You went into an aircon room and you had energy and clear and you could meditate really well. So you can see what is the middle path there by what works and what doesn't work for you. Yes. Yeah.
Perhaps that quantum leap idea of that you spoke about, that fundamentally these stages of enlightenment are quantum leaps, and that you're progressing along in a certain direction and then you really have a sea change. With the other Buddha's teaching and the description that the Buddha talked about when he said, he who practices the Dharma is like a man who walks into the ocean and he slowly but steadily gets surrounded by the sea. And that sea, or that the taste of the Dharma is the taste of freedom, and it just slowly, gradually surrounds you. So the implication of that metaphor is that it is a slow, gradual transition where the sense of freedom slowly pervades one's whole life. How do those two metaphors jive with each other, the quantum leap and the gradual transition?
I would actually say that the quantum leap is that first experiencing the Dharma of a stream winner. And from then on, you're in the ocean, you found the sea, now you sort of, it goes gradually from that point on.
Yeah, but Arjun, I don't know whether I'm a stream winner and I experience that gradual experience of walking into the ocean. I don't think I'm a stream winner.
Yeah.
You know, I really understand what that second metaphor means.
Yes, well, I think that those two metaphors are obviously there, but it is. The idea of that stream winner is, again, it's one of those events. One of the rules which I already mentioned earlier, that we're not, as monks and as bhikkhunis, you're not allowed to tell other people of any of these supernormal attainments, you know, like jhanas or like stream winning. But you can tell another monk, especially, you know, you're supposed to really tell your teacher if you have any of these attainments. And there's a rule that if you actually lie about those attainments, you say you're a stream winner and you know you're not, you're just boasting, then that's such a serious offence, it's disrobable. So when I started reading that Vinaya, especially in the commentaries, I came across this, like what you call these days, a questionnaire. How the teacher should question a disciple if they claim to be a stream winner. So I had all these questions you're supposed to ask to find out if that person was a stream winner or they weren't the stream winner. And one of the questions was, you have to ask them, when did that happen? Where did it happen? That you were a stream winner. And that made it very, very clear that stream winning, at least, is an event. An event which happens at a certain time at a certain place. Actually, I shouldn't tell you that, because now if you ask me, I haven't got the advantage on you. But no, we keep it open to everybody. So it made it very clear that that is an event. The others are more like the gradual, that where they say that once you see that Dhamma, there is a big change in the way that you look at life, the way you see yourself and your place in the world and what the world actually is. There is a sea change there. And from that time, they say you make much of that Dhamma, you develop it, you cultivate it. Once you have that taste of the Dhamma, you've got your feet in the water, then yes, you keep walking. And the other simile, which sort of confirms that, is that the shipwreck sailor simile, which I like very much. When you give similes for these things, it's much easier to comprehend than if you just give, you know, a few philosophical explanations. And the shipwreck sailor, number four, is someone who's floating in the water and they see dry land in the distance. So that's seeing dry land. You actually, there's an event there, something you actually see, which can change you. And from that, you start swimming. And that swimming is a gradual process. The seeing is a sudden process, but the swimming towards dry land is a gradual process. You get closer and closer and closer and closer. And then the other sort of sudden process is when you can feel the dry land underneath your feet. You're still in the water, but you can start walking now. And that's the non-returner. And the last one is when you're standing on dry land. And that's the arahat. So that is one of the things. But certainly for the Buddha, when you've got all those things all in one go, I gave a sim, I think it was in Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. Now, why is it that sometimes people can actually go through those stages really quickly? You know, they just see the Dhamma, they become enlightened all in one go, basically. You know, they weren't even a stream winner before. And boom, bang, 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 you know, they see everything, like Bahia. And I said that it's like, you know, being caught in the waves. You just get thrown up onto the shore, like into a great tidal wave or tsunami. You get thrown up to the shore very, very quickly. And that certainly is a traumatic event. And that seems to be like with the Buddha. You know, very, very, obviously just beforehand, not really knowing what he was doing, doing all these austerities. And it doesn't actually say how long, maybe in a few days, maybe a couple of weeks. They do say that he was so emaciated he had to get his body into good health first of all, which obviously would have taken a while. And when he was sort of healthy again, and that morning having that milk rice from Sujata, and then he was healthy and fit, and then he became the Arahat, the Buddha that evening. So yeah, there is a sense of part of the path being something sudden, and part of the path being a gradual. We can have questions now, because this was a long sutta, but as you say, it's not really that interesting. It's just the Buddha telling about all his powers and his achievements and what he's been through. So you can ask a few questions, because...
It was just the second part of my last question about the will, but when you said, wasn't the Buddha already...
A stream winner, or at least I'd say it was a watch returner in his previous life, yes.
Yeah, because you said, this is my last birth when he woke up.
Correct,
anyway,
yes.
But when he was doing all those ascetic practices, he was kind of, this is the second part of my last question, he was kind of cultivating his will, and was that kind of impeding his path to just let go all of a sudden, because it was like gaining momentum using all this willpower?
Indeed.
Maybe
just join those two questions together. That the thing is very compelling evidence to show that the Buddha was a once returner when he was reborn in this last life. It's not convincing 100%, but it's compelling evidence, so that seems to be a very likely possibility. But as many people who recall their past lives when they are born, it's usually around the age of 7 or 8, it tends to fade away from them. And even I was just seeing, somebody sent me a link of a boy in Thailand. He's 3 years of age, and he's doing the Thai chanting. And it was, somebody said that to me, it's actually Jagannatha sent that to me. It was on the TV in Thailand recently, they were talking about it. And even though this little boy has got some prompting from his parents, you know, any of the monks in our monastery, you know, even like Mike, you've been a monk, how hard it is to learn the chanting. There's a three-year-old, he does a pretty good job of that chanting. Good enough that I would take him to one of the house blessings, and I'd be very happy he could chant very well. And there are some monks, you know, which I take them and make sure there's enough monks so that, you know, they don't stop everything because they don't know it. So it's very impressive, and I've seen many cases of that, of young boys, young girls, when they're very, very young, remembering their past lives, but when they get to about 7 or 8, it seems that they lose it. And they sort of, I think even the Holiness of Dalai Lama said that. In his early years, he remembers previous life. When he gets about 7 or 8, he loses that memory. As if the new life takes over. And that would be what happens with a stream winner or a once returner. You basically lose it, forget it, and you become an ordinary person. But then there's something inside of you, you know, which is, can have the inclinations from the past. So because of that stream winning in the past, or that once returning in the past, he did those asceticisms, forgot it, but he still had that seed from the past which were to propel him to actually to become the Buddha. Because remember, he recognized that he was a young kid under the rose apple tree. And that must have been some recollection of a past life, knowing how to meditate and get into the jhanas. And that was the last time he did it. Simply because you forget when you get to 7 or 8 years of age and you have another life, basically. So all those years he forgot, probably grew up with an ordinary kid playing around, going out with girls later on, getting married, having kids. So yes, usually the ascetic practices does give you a strong sense of will. But then again, he had that seed from the past. Does that make any sense? Okay, you're nodding your head. Yes, I have a question, Sam. Over here. No, you do, because this is going online over the world.
The ascetic practices that we just read out. They're all external. And he talks about the wisdom part. It was later on that he has the wisdom, got the wisdom, saw it inside. And I think that's a little, one of the lessons that we can learn from this, to think that it's always outside, the things we do, the things he did, rather than the wisdom that he had. And if we look at it that way, he tried all the things he could possibly do outside, and it didn't work.
That's right, yeah. So restrained outside, but never really restrained inside. That's a very good point. But it's also that point which I've made many, many times, which is going on from what Daniya and what Venerable Upasama said. It's always in Buddhism, it's wisdom power rather than willpower, which is the cause of enlightenment, peace, everything else. The willpower is what you do develop doing ascetic practices. It's very hard to endure such pain and discomfort. And the wisdom power is much more powerful than any will. That's why wisdom power is what works. There is that story, again, just to filling out this, making it an interesting session, because much of what we say here is, yes, it's part of the Buddha Sutras, but it doesn't really get deep inside of us. It was when I went to stay with Ajahn Mahabua, who was a very strong-minded monk, and he gave one teaching when I was staying there. He said at the beginning, this was for the visiting Western monk, being me. He said it in Thai. He didn't realize that my Thai was very, very good. I understood perfectly what he said. And it was a self-deprecatory speech where he mentioned when he was studying under Ajahn Mun, when he had malaria, he decided to use willpower to fight that disease, because when it came to the time when the monks did their chores, even though he was in the middle of a fever, feeling very weak, he forced himself out of his bed, got dressed, went down to take a broom and started sweeping the paths, even though he was shaking with the malaria fever. And when his teacher Ajahn Mun saw him, instead of praising his willpower, oh, you're a great monk, you don't give in to diseases, you know, your will is very strong, Ajahn Mun really criticized and scolded him, saying, that is not the way of a Buddhist. The way of a Buddhist is to investigate, not to control. And that's a very powerful piece of wisdom and teaching from Ajahn Mun. Use wisdom power, investigate. Don't use willpower. And that was one of the very important teachings which I got from one of the great Thai forest masters. If you are sick, don't fight it. Investigate it. Use wisdom power, not willpower. If you are got some problem in meditation, don't fight it. Use wisdom power. Investigate it. This is what we mean by wisdom power. Whatever obstacle you have in life, don't just fight. Investigate. That's the path of Buddhism, according to Ajahn Mun.
Flashed on something you said about the rose apple tree, connecting that. All the austerities are very painful. And then the Buddha remembered that pleasurable experience that he had as a young child. And then the teaching that he came out with eventually was you have to have the Piti Sukha in order to get into the jhanas, which is very sort of against all the Jain practices.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting, you know, contrast.
Indeed. And it's also what you say is true, that at that particular time it does seem from the evidence that the Buddhism was number two religion, that Jains had many more followers than the Buddha did at that time. So that was the context. I'll just finish it off now with paragraph 64. Or paragraph 63. Rightly speaking, were it to be said of anyone, a being not subject to delusion has appeared in the world for the welfare and happiness of many, out of compassion for the world, for the good welfare and happiness of gods and humans. It is of me, indeed, that rightly speaking this should be said. Now, on that occasion, the Venerable Nagasamala was standing behind the Blessed One, fanning him. Then he said to the Blessed One, "It is wonderful, Venerable Sir, it is marvelous. As I listened to this discourse on the Dhamma, the hairs of my body stood up. Venerable Sir, what is the name of this discourse on the Dhamma? Ask that, Naika Samadhi, you may remember this discourse on the Dhamma as a hair-raising discourse. Now, I don't know about the hair of the body, because monks don't have much hair on their body, but nevertheless, whatever there was rose up. Very good, okay. This is what the Blessed One said to Venerable Naika Samadhi, was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So that became known as the Mahasi Anada Sutta. It's one which I haven't read out yet, and you can probably see why. It is long, it hasn't got some really oomphy parts. It has got that little part which makes it very clear what Ekayana means, going in one direction only. It is the Buddha basically claiming his reason to be a Buddha, the reason to be a teacher, the reasons why he's been there and done that. So when this monk, ex-monk, Sunakata, started criticizing him, he said, well, look, you know, we would like to criticize me because, you know, this is my, if you like, my CV. This is my reason why I am a teacher. Yes. Very dumb. Oh, can we have the microphone first, sorry? We didn't want to put on the worldwide that makes you feel dumb.
this Venerable
Nagasamara.
Nagasamara, if the comment say that he's in the first 20 years, then the last paragraph say this is the Buddha at 80 years old. It doesn't tell you the year.
No, but apparently the Buddha was 80 years of age when he passed away. That seems to be accepted. And now it says here, now old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, comes to the last age, my years have turned 80. Now remember that really means, you know, the Asian tradition, that means he's 79 years have passed, he's in his 80th year. So we'd say he was 79 and a bit.
I'm not very particular with it. The comment notes say that this Venerable Naga Samara is attendant his first 20 years.
Oh.
If we say that, if he got 45, I mean this is give and take, 45 yeah. years, so he has to be 60 years old and not 80 years old.
Indeed, yeah. So that's a bit of a contradiction there. Kata?
And then Saraputta and this, the framework of the timing just isn't there.
Yeah, sometimes the timing gets a bit mixed up. But it's not really essential to the teachings over there. And you might say that Nagasamala, maybe he was took over from Venerable Ananda for a day or two towards the end.
Yes, you can give all this, okay.
But we don't really know, basically.
Yeah, okay. I mean, okay, I think it's not a big issue there. I think for me, what I'm more interested is this Vibhanga or something that
you
put.
Oh, there's
this sutta with all these close reference.
Yes.
How important is this Vibhanga to understand this sutta? It
okay.
looks like if you don't have these ideas of this Vibhanga, this sutta is so irrelevant and so dummy and it's so ridiculous and it's so funny.
Yeah. Now, sometimes the commentary, which is what's quoted in the back, sometimes it's inaccurate. So having spent a long time studying these things, sometimes it's very helpful. Sometimes it's not helpful at all. So that's why the explanations in the back, sometimes they give a bit of extra information, sometimes they don't. I like just to have it stand on its own and just to read the sutta and get the information directly from the sutta rather than having it interpreted by monks 500 to 1,000 years later.
Yeah, but then it looks like this sutta, if you don't have this Vibhanga knowledge,
yeah.
this sutta is so difficult to apprehend or appreciate. I mean, to me, yeah. if I read something, it's either I don't understand, but I can always open my mind and understand somebody's point
yes,
of view.
Yes.
Okay, this one I don't understand. I'm very dumb. So I'm trying to understand from what other people felt. So looks like this sutta, if you don't have this Vibhanga knowledge, this sutta is not meant for us. Because there are so many phrases that is so out of ordinary.
Yes. But I think mostly that is just sometimes it was to edify people. Sometimes when people want to have faith in their teacher rather than the faith in the teachings, they want to know what the teacher can do. So this is one of those suttas where it's very similar to some of the suttas you find in the Digha Nikaya. But the main purpose is edification rather than teaching. Edification means trying to inspire some people with, you know, some of the things which the Buddha could do, rather than just, you know, strong teachings on how to become enlightened and how to overcome defilements. So it has a different purpose.
Just last question, can I just ask?
Yes.
How important should I understand these four kind of generation?
That's not really important at all. It just gives a snapshot of the level of biology knowledge 2600 years ago.
Because
it's not saying that that is the way it has to be and it always will be. If the Buddha said it, it must be right. That is actually how the Buddha understood things that time ago.
Okay.
Thank you, Che. Okay, we'll finish off now. So it's 4:30. Thank you for listening. And that's one other sutra I can cross off from the list now it's been done. So let's just pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, and then we can all go.